Hello and welcome to the Culture File Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and nearly half an hour's worth of spoken words, assorted not quite background sounds, and some heartily felt eye rolling. This time we get a savour of things to come at Paris's Taste Week. Orrit Gat has a celebration of pigeon kind, and Paddy Woodworth has a new book for the Naturalist Bookshelf. But we begin, fittingly for this election week, with a good firm eye roll. Spinning up since the weekend is the second edition of the Beta Digital Arts and Technology Festival, hosted in Dublin's Liberties and in venues around the city. One of the events is an exhibition of critical digital art called Unsettling the Algorithm in the Bank venue in James's Street, where, among the headphones and the headsets, you can find two supersized robotic eyeballs rolling periodically as they watch over a screen on which Elon Musk occasionally appears. And you might also catch, as Culturefile did, the eye's creator, Caroline McCaughill, performing some running repairs. What are you doing there?
I'm just tightening up the eyeballs. Sometimes your eyeballs go a little bit wonky.
It's been a long day.
It's been a long day for them, you know what I mean? So they need a little bit of a tweak and adjustment so they're not looking askew.
Very nice blue eyes there. It's the size, really, that makes them so winning, isn't it?
I guess they're pretty dominant giant eyeballs. How would we describe what size would they be? They're about 2 foot each.
A good-sized beach ball.
A good-sized beach ball. And actually, yeah, I played around with a few beach balls first to try and gauge what size the actual eyes would be. So I actually had an inflatable eyeball beach ball for a while in my flat. We're in the exhibition Unsettling the Algorithm, Seeds of Resistance, at the Beta Festival in Digital Hub in Dublin, for the international listeners. My decolonised name is Caroline McCaughill. It's a queer and decolonised name. What we see here is a piece called This Is How I Roll, which is a set of giant mechanised robotic eyeballs, which I describe as an exercise in queer feminist DIY robotics.
I'll just switch them on there for you now again, so you can see them in action. So
they've begun to roll from the back of its head.
Yeah, they're basically it's basically an eye rolling robot. And the thing was, I found that I could only do so much eye rolling, and there's a lot of it that needs to be done. Especially lately. So I just found that I had to maybe outsource the job and build a machine that would do some of my eye rolling for me if I was getting a bit tired of it, you know. I'm like, I love eye rolling, don't get me wrong. But sometimes, you know, you just have to give the eyes a rest and get a robotic stand-in for yourself to do a bit of the eye rolling for you. The machinery is very much in the land of double-sided sticky tape, is how I describe it. A very basic wooden framework, and then two giant eyeballs which are running off Arduinos and servos.
That's a little tiny, very cheap portable computer. So your servos then are controlled by the Arduinos, are making the eyes move, as you say, giving a bit of an eye roll every now and then.
Yeah, they're giving a bit of an eye roll, and they're triggered actually by a video image over there at the desk on the right. And the idea with this, and kind of another project that you would have seen before, is it's set up like a kind of a DIY feminist queer robotics lab. And sometimes I appear actually as the roboticist in the lab when the thing breaks down, which it does quite often.
Like you've just been fixing it.
I have. You've just been lucky enough to see a live performance by the artist, roboticist, fixing the eyeball.
So there's something happens on the screen. Now, they're not looking directly at the screen. Of course, they're not looking at all. But it's somehow the images. We're just seeing a lot of rabbits, and there was a Cybertruck there.
The premise of this was originally a Twitter scraper. Right. So originally what it did was it ran through various different Twitter accounts from large news feeds, and it had a selection of words that made my eyes roll, and when it found them on Twitter, it eye rolled. And what has happened in the meantime is that Elon Musk has taken over Twitter and he's closed down access to the APIs, which means people can't scrape Twitter anymore, which is actually quite a big deal, because It's closed down a lot of artworks that are based on using Twitter, using the data of Twitter. It's closed down a lot of research around Twitter as well. So what's kind of interesting on that is if you go onto like the Twitter website, Musk will still say, oh yeah, we really facilitate out-of-the-box thinking and like all sorts of creative projects by artists and researchers. And hey, come use our APIs, but you can't use them really. You can only get like tiny amounts of data off them, not enough to get eyes rolling for sure. So interesting, then the only thing that I had a chance of scraping was Truth Social. And I kind of went like, oh God, I really didn't want to scrape Truth Social. I just didn't want to give it any coverage. On the Twitter thing, it seems innocuous enough, but it's not. Why he did it was to stop people harvesting data to train AI. So, and we know, as we know, data is the new gold, or nearly the old gold now at this stage. And
Spice.
What I see, what he's done is kind of like the new enclosures, the new internet enclosures. I do a lot of looking at robots, and I look at a lot of robot bodies as bodies, potential bodies for AI, for artificial intelligence. You know, what kind of, it's a distributed intelligence, and you kind of expect it more to be in like an octopus body, which has like distributed intelligence across its arms or whatever, you know what I mean? And instead they're coming out in these really kind of hackneyed humanoid Terminator type forms, very masculine, very kind of militaristic really, you know. And what's interesting about them though is, even though they are pretty much all seeing, because number one, they've got like a lot of 360 cameras on them and they're connected up to like networked AI, there's no real visible eyes on them, right? And the reason this is because like Rodney, and what I think it is it's from Rodney Brooks, the father of robotics. He was the first person to start, you know, designing from, starting from, had, he realized that we think through the body. So a lot of, when artificial intelligence was being built before, it was being built in hierarchical top-down structures, and that didn't really work. And so we got into a more distributed thing. And then also the whole idea of learning, we learn from actually moving through our environment. And what he said, which is key, he said that when something has eyes, you will think that it's going to kill you because you become prey. It has been incredibly thought through why those eyes aren't there, because most of these robots, including the early Rodney Brooks stuff, is funded by DARPA. When I build a robot, I build them kind of in opposition to the funding levels of DARPA and to DARPA's, obviously, ideals and stuff like that. And even the way that they're so kind of like make and do built is just a rejection of the large amounts, or a commentary on the large amounts of funding, the huge swathes of funding that goes into military robotics or military AI or military tech in general. And to go, look, we can make something more beautiful and more hopeful and a different way of working. I'm very hopeful about technology. I think I've said that to you before. I don't know, basic love of it and thinking that it can do good, you know, it's just in the absolute wrong hands.
Caroline McCaughill there with This Is How I Roll. Unsettling the Algorithm runs until November 17th, as does the Beta Festival itself. And also as part of that this week is Noir, the Cannes Immersive Cinema Award-winning augmented reality experience, which is encounterable at TCD until Sunday. BetaFestival.ie for all the details. Now, earlier today, or later tomorrow, if you're a time traveller or know how to use podcasts, or both, we had, or will have, not really going to do this all the way through, so let's just go back to assuming that other timelines and other tenses exist. We had a Culture File Day at the National Botanic Gardens. Among the events, Paddy Woodworth hosted a panel of nature illustrators and artists to talk about their work in capturing the natural world for pages and screen. And of course, when that good work is done, it may just be that their creations will receive the ultimate accolade of a place on Paddy Woodworth's bookshelf, which is exactly what happened to the work of Melissa Culhan, which appears in Michael Fewer's book for young people, Naturama.
The American nature writer Rachel Carson published landmark books like Silent Spring that changed the course of environmental history, leading to the banning of the pesticide DDT in the 1960s. But she never forgot that a healthy relationship with nature begins in childhood pleasures, not in adult polemics. One of her finest books, celebrated on this bookshelf some years back, is A Sense of Wonder. It offers rich autobiographical insights into how she led her young nephew out into the natural world and so enriched and changed his life. Naturama, clearly and accessibly written by the prolific Michael Feuer and delightfully and lavishly illustrated by Melissa Dillon, does something similar for Irish readers. It offers a host of avenues into the pleasures and excitement of nature observation just beyond our doorsteps, from gardens through parks, farms and countryside, all the way to the seashore. The book is structured around the seasons, like Feuer's more recent journal for adults, The Natural Year. In Naturama, he starts with spring. And you can see immediately how skilled and effective he is at building in relatively complex topics unobtrusively into his text. For example, he reminds us at the start of each season that it is the tilt of our planet towards the sun, or away from it, that causes the dramatic changes in the way plants and animals manifest themselves as the year turns. He also starts, quite literally, with the basics of nature, since the first creature introduced is the earthworm. Aware that this creature disgusts some children as much as it may fascinate others, he's quick to point out its valuable functions, both in cleaning the soil and in aerating it with its burrows, to the benefit of the plants, which he then introduces. The web of linkages that underlies all ecology is thus gently introduced and recurs throughout the book. Likewise, the theme of pollination is woven repeatedly into the text, with the underlying but never preachy message that we need to take proper care of all parts of nature so that the whole great complex structure on which we depend may flourish. He leavens the science aspects with folklore and children's rhymes, and frequently introduces Irish names and their translations. A woodlouse, for example, is Míle Criona os Gaeilge. This means a thousand wrinkles, a phrase that is surely likely to imprint the recognition of this tiny creature in children's minds. The beautifully produced large format edition by Gill enables Dillon's illustrations to fully inhabit and inform the pages, moving hand in glove with the text. Her vivid images of bluebells, for example, occupy three times as much space as is dedicated to the plant in words. Her portrayals comfortably combine a kind of cartoonish impact in the best sense and scientific accuracy. Her lovely portrayal of a millipede and a centipede is a case in point. Feuer also reminds readers that nature is very closely related to culture. Willow trees, for example, give us products ranging from utilitarian baskets to exquisite harps, including, as he points out, the great harp attributed to Brian Boru in Trinity College's old library. Some statistics here may surprise parents as much as children. Slugs have 27,000 teeth, and swifts can carry as many as 1,000 bugs back to their nestlings, all in a single bulge in their throats. The subjects covered shift quickly, more notes than narratives, but this is probably just the right pace to capture the roving attention of many young readers. So one minute you can be reading about wrens squeezing together collectively in a tiny hole to stay warm in winter, and the next you can be gazing at illustrations of the night sky and grasping how two of the stars in the Plough constellation point to the pole star and how this line always points north. As a bonus, this big slim book is accompanied by a small stout one, a Naturama journal, which offers children, and indeed some adults, opportunities to note their observations throughout the year, stimulated by a treasure trove of suggestions from Feuer and images from Dillon. And you can learn a range of skills that tie us closer to nature, from making birds' nest boxes to planting seeds. This book was published in 2016, prior to Robert McFarlane and Jackie Morris's not dissimilar author-artist collaboration, The Lost Words. It plays a very similar role in reconnecting children in particular to the natural world. As another reviewer has already said, every home and every school should have one. Michael Feuer and Gill kindly donated copies to a refugee group I work with during the COVID pandemic. This resulted in a beautiful telling photo of two Mongolian children absorbed completely in its text and images, learning about creatures no doubt as exotic to them as their yaks are to us.
Paddy Woodworth on Michael Feuer's Naturama, featuring the illustrations of Melissa Culhan. And if you'd like to hear our panel of nature artists recorded at the National Botanic Gardens, that programme will be broadcast at 6:30 p.m. on December 14th. Now, Taste Week took place in France recently, an annual event sponsored by the Department of Agriculture aimed at promoting the business and practice of flavour to young people in France. Anne McCluskey took the opportunity to talk to some of those working on the forefronts of tastes and techniques at stalwart Paris institutions, from the Ritz Escoffier Culinary School to the Institut Pasteur.
The black currant and mustard sorbet served with a duck smoked with wine shoots and a red cabbage carpaccio. We've got this time code in the degustation. We start with the duck, and when you're going to eat the duck, the blackcurrant sorbet is trying to melt, so it's like a trip.
Flavor is not in the dish, flavor is not in the glass, flavor is in the brain.
Autumn 1884. Auguste Escoffier, the visionary chef who shaped the future of gastronomy, experimenting and inventing sumptuous flavors, made a singular encounter. It was with César Ritz. Together, they brought the culinary art to a whole new dimension at the Ritz Hotel that they created on the prestigious Place Vendôme in Paris. Autumn 2024, 140 years on, I'm pushing the revolving door into the legendary venue to meet with chef Vincent Pollard at the Ritz Escoffier Culinary School that hands down the savoir-faire of the great innovative master to future generations.
I joined the Ritz Escoffier School almost 2 years ago as a chef trainer. I think the school is first the embodiment of French excellence. The work we've done over the last 20 years has led to considerate technical and technological advances. But the fun fact is, at the same time, we are witnessing a return to the old way, taking advantage of the culinary knowledge of our ancestors, from ancestral fermentation techniques to the use of ancient seeds, the cooking over an open fire. I'd like to focus on the flavor themselves, which have changed the way I think we consume. A new technique like cryo concentration brought about by the joint work of chef Yannick Aleno, a 3 Michelin star, and a physical chemist named Bruno Gousseau, represents a real innovation, even for me a revolution in the way flavors are concentrated. For 200 years, we've learned to concentrate flavors on a heat source by evaporation. Whereas extraction consists of cooking a product under vacuum at just the right temperature for a given time to extract only the essence of the product at its highest level of aromatic concentration. It's a distillation made by cold and negative temperature.
So we can look forward to a festival of flavors in the future, Vincent?
I think we are just at the beginning of an unexpected journey.
When you enhance your memory, you become a better taster. My name is Gabriel Lépouzet. I'm a brain scientist working here in Paris in the Institut Pasteur in the laboratory called Perception and Memory in the neuroscience department. And we study especially how the brain make sense of all the sensory modality from the environment. We know that from the when we do brain imaging of food experts. I take an example of sommeliers that don't have a better nose in terms of sensory detection. They have a better brain. Perfumers the same. We call them the nose, but we shouldn't call them the brains because they have a bigger brain, especially in the olfactory zone. They have a bigger library of odors. Memory, we can train our memory. And that's the good news. We all can all become a perfumer. We can all become a sommelier. The brain has kind of a hierarchy of senses. Some senses are more salient and more important for us and more relevant for us than others. And when you put a contradiction between odors and vision, color and odors, for example, the brain prefers to bet on vision than olfaction. Let's talk about also gustation, all the five tastes. Sweet, salty, bitter, sour, umami. Well, we can talk about umami because this taste is kind of a mystery for European tasters. And when you translate it into English or French, it turns into delicious, which is not very helpful as a word. And basically, umami is the ability of our body to sense the amino acids, which are the bricks of our protein. What about the future? The new techniques that are emerging to preserve, concentrate, isolate, purify. All these techniques that are sometimes coming also from side field, like perfumery. What we know from perfumery can help a lot also the food and for the pleasure of the taste.
Chefs and scientists today, they're telling us that tomorrow's cuisine and flavors will be innovative beyond our imagination of taste. Will our senses have to sort of unlearn and relearn, or how will it happen, all these new flavors that we're going to be tasting?
In fact, your brain starts to mix stuff that are different by exposition. I talk about this because when we have people from tropical countries, from Brazil, for example, or South Asia coming to France, they have a lot of difficulty to figure out the difference between strawberry and raspberry, which for us is obvious because it's our reference, it's our everyday red fruits, but for them, these are exotic fruits. And when they come to France, they have to learn new fruits, they have to and create new memories in the head, and enhancing our ability to taste would be also involving enhancing our memory. It's really important. It's, when you enhance your memory, you become a better taster. So at the end, flavor is not in the dish, flavor is not in the glass, flavor is in the brain.
Gabrielle Lepousset there, neuroscientist at the Institut Pasteur. And you heard also from Vincent Pellat at the Ritz-Escoffier Culinary School, and McCluskey was the reporter. I mentioned earlier our big day out at the National Botanic Gardens on Saturday morning, which, let's not forget, is still in the future for some of us. We gathered for a session called Wing Muses. We asked some of our favourite writers, including John Banville and Sarah Baum, to champion a bird they fancy. For the writer Orit Gat, that bird is the pigeon, as she now explains.
If you ask me what my favourite bird is, my immediate answer will be pigeons. I have a specific image in my mind when I say that. A painting by the Belgian artist Laurens Doriot called Butterflies and Birds, which shows this messy domestic scene with a parent asleep and a child, his head in a cardboard box that he tore the front out of, almost dropping a box of food because three pigeons came in through the open window and reached for it. The cat is also arching its back and hissing. That is to say, pigeons are the subject of art. A few years ago, Julien Charrier and Julius von Bismarck made Some Pigeons Are More Equal Than Others, a project in which pigeons are trapped quickly, airbrushed with non-toxic dyes, and are then re-released into the city. It is a work that relies completely on pigeons' pervasiveness in cities, and it introduces this small painterly shift to make us reorient how we think about our environment. At the High Line in New York City, there is a new monument called Dinosaur by artist Ivan Argut, which is a massive pigeon overlooking 10th Avenue, an inversion of the tendency of urban dwellers to ignore the wild things we share our space with. At the Venice Biennale, Maurizio Cattelan planted 200 stuffed pigeons across the air shafts and tops of the Italian pavilion. The Tate collection has a drawing by Turner of four pigeons. Video artist Frank Heath has a work called War Pigeon, in which a character describes a pigeon that shows up wherever he goes, diving into the history of war pigeons, city life, the Manhattan Project, and international banking. Recently, at a gallery in New York, I saw Anna Rubin's video, The Gram, where Rubin attaches a GoPro camera to a homing pigeon headed from Midtown back to the artist's studio in the Bronx. It's a 26-minute journey, soundtracked by flapping wings and the whoosh of the wind. It's kind of unstable, uncertain, vulnerable. It makes you feel a very real empathy. Of course, the reason pigeons appear in these works is their ubiquity. But what I think about here is their romance, specifically that they carry narrative. Pigeons have an innate homing ability. That is how Pigeon Post works. They memorize home, a way there, a series of monuments, but perhaps also a feeling, something innate and mysterious. Humans don't understand it. We don't know exactly where they journey from or how, nor do we know how they navigate. John Day, in his book Homing, describes a theory that pigeons are connected to their lofts and their flock by a kind of psychic elastic band which allows them to travel to the ends of the earth while always feeling the pull of home. It's this pull that we humans recognize in pigeons, and it feels like a metaphor, like a mirror of the human. Under the Wikipedia category, individual domesticated pigeons, almost all of them are war pigeons, some are racers. But perhaps we can release pigeons from all these negative connotations, from them being pests to warriors or racers, and just let them be among us. Pigeons are synanthropes, from the ancient Greek syn, meaning together, and anthropos, man, that is to say, organisms and animals who live alongside humans. Day describes how pigeons live in an almost human world, and they live in that world in almost human ways. Pigeons evolved from rock doves. They have no predators in cities and learn to live by skimming off what humans leave behind. My friend Harry told me this. His tone was, "We ruined them," but that's not how I feel. I think of them as something natural and wild that I get to see all the time, that I share the world with. And like me, they like their neighborhood. They have a home. Who am I to challenge why or how we share the space in Southeast London? I wonder, what would it feel like if one day all the pigeons flew off, leaving our skies empty, our cities quiet from the cooing, our other synanthropes without companions? I wouldn't like it. I like living alongside something that is wild, but still wants to be my neighbor. That is to say, we have to love the things around us.
Orrit Gat there on the pigeon, and you can hear more about the pigeon and the other chosen birds, as well as more of DJ Lightsey's bird soundscape in our special edition of the Culture File debate, which will be broadcast over what we freely call the holidays. But let's not think on that now, for that brings to a close this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more avine outreach next Saturday tea time. Till then, bye now.